the growing threat of antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
So we have a variety of different types of gram-negative bacteria that are, in some cases, becoming resistant to every available antibiotic. We're also seeing, almost as scary, common bacteria like E. coli that we do have some IV therapy left for, but that is becoming resistant to everything oral. Common belly infections, prostate infections that are acquired in the community, not in hospitals, not in nursing homes, and they can't be treated with any oral antibiotic.
That's Dr. Brad Spellberg. We'll talk with him about his book, Rising Plague, and what happens to the horizon after all the factories are torn down.
Nothing but blue skies is what you have left after the factory leaves, but it's also a blank slate. It's something you can use to build a new way of urban living.
That's Edward McClelland. We talk with him about his book, Nothing But Blue Skies. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. At least 2 million Americans are infected by antibiotic-resistant pathogens each year, according to a recent report by the Centers for Disease Control. At least 23,000 people die as a result. Antibiotic-resistant infections already cost the U.S. healthcare system between $20 and $30 billion a year, a cost that is only likely to increase. My guest, infectious disease specialist Brad Spellberg, is on the front line of the fight against antibiotic-resistant infections. A practicing physician, he teaches at UCLA's medical school and is the author of Rising Plague, The Global Threat from Deadly Bacteria and Our Dwindling Arsenal to Fight Them. Spellberg says there's a perfect storm of drug-resistant infectious disease and lack of new antibiotics with which to treat it. I asked him to explain this perfect storm.
The problem with antibiotic resistance is not new. It's been around since we first discovered antibiotics, and frankly, really since before we discovered antibiotics. I mean, the thing that people often forget is that antibiotics were not invented by us. They were invented by bacteria. Bacteria have been using antibiotics to kill each other for 2 billion years or so. And in those 2 billion years of microbial warfare, they have created resistance mechanisms to protect themselves against the antibiotics that they use. So resistance has always been there, and it emerged fairly quickly clinically after the first use of antibiotics. The difference is now is that when resistance used to emerge, there were enough companies that were inventing new antibiotics or discovering new ones that they would just come out with the next generation of antibiotics to beat the resistance. And in the last 20 to 30 years, as investment in discovery of new antibiotics has fallen off, now we have the resistance catching up and we don't have new weapons coming out to keep us a step ahead.
And I'd like to get into exactly why we did fall off. But before we do that, let's talk about the real case that you start your book, Rising Plague, with. You started out with the case of a Mrs. B. Tell us, our listeners, what was going on with her.
So this was a otherwise healthy woman who had been at home for several weeks complaining for the last couple of weeks of not feeling well, joint aches, muscle aches, intermittent fevers, and feeling run down. And when I saw her in the emergency room, I thought that she might have some form of arthritis, maybe thyroid disease. I thought infection was much less likely because it had been sort of brewing for a while. It wasn't like a rapid onset, rapid progression type thing. And then when we admitted her to the hospital, early the next morning, she just crashed. She just all of a sudden just crashed. Her blood pressure plummeted. She began to seize. And to make a long story short, she ended up having MRSA in her blood that she had acquired in the community, MRSA being a highly resistant form of staph infection.
And is this something you had seen a lot of at that point?
That was at a time sort of just as MRSA was emerging in communities. This resistant form of bacteria had been seen in hospitals since sort of the late 60s and 70s, but it had never escaped the hospital. It was always something you picked up in the hospital. And in the late 90s and early 2000s, it began to emerge in communities in a real way. And she was sort of in the meat of that curve, right when that emergence was occurring.
And what happened to her?
She ended up surviving, but the bacteria that had been in her blood seeded her spine, and she ended up paralyzed below the waist as the infection got into her spinal cord. So while she survived, it was still a catastrophic outcome. And of course, it was a very prolonged hospitalization, lots of morbidity, lots of expense, and then a very bad outcome.
And is this kind of related to the flesh-eating bacteria that we heard about? I mean, for example, I believe Jim Henson of the Muppets died of that.
Well, the flesh-eating bacteria is actually a disease that we call necrotizing fasciitis. And what it isn't necessarily caused by one specific bacteria. There's multiple forms of it. Most of those forms are not antibiotic resistant. It's not an issue that they're resistant. It's that they are lethal even though they are susceptible to antibiotics. What happened with MRSA is that as it began to emerge in communities, we began to see and were the first to report cases of necrotizing fasciitis, or what the public calls the flesh-eating bacteria, caused by MRSA. And so you had this convergence of a really antibiotic-resistant form of bacteria that was also, oh, by the way, causing this flesh-eating disease. And that was a really bad combo.
So this is one of them, MRSA. What are some of the other major bacteria that we're dealing with that have become antibiotic-resistant and that might be in the community as well?
MRSA was, I think, a huge antibiotic resistance problem at that point in the early 2000s. Since then, there have actually been a number of drugs that have either become newly approved or we've relearned how to use that are really old drugs. And so we actually now do have antibiotics for MRSA. The real problem with MRSA is it's community spread. And so what we need for that is a vaccine as opposed to new antibiotics per se. But there are a variety of other antibiotics, a variety of other bacteria now that we really are running out of antibiotics for. And these are typically members of a category of bacteria we call gram-negative. So you might hear this term gram-negative. All that means is in a laboratory, when we apply a specific color stain called a gram stain, they stain red instead of purple, which would be gram positive. And the reason they stain red is that they have a very complicated cell surface structure. So they have a double cell membrane with a cell wall in between. And that very tricky exterior armor of the bacteria makes it difficult to get antibiotics into the bacteria and makes it easy for the bacteria to rapidly become resistant to those antibiotics. So we have a variety of different types of gram-negative bacteria that are, in some cases, becoming resistant to every available antibiotics, that we're now seeing routinely infections that can't be treated with any available antibiotic. We're also seeing, almost as scary, common bacteria like E. coli, which is also a gram-negative, that we do have some IV therapy left for, but that is becoming resistant to everything oral. So these are infections, millions of infections per year, for example, urinary tract infections, common belly infections, prostate infections that are acquired in the community, not in hospitals, not in nursing homes, and they can't be treated with any oral antibiotic. And so first, the doctor doesn't know that it's resistant, so you get a pill and you go home and you're not any better and you start to get worse and worse and worse. And you come back to the hospital. If we figure it out, then you have to be hospitalized and put on intravenous antibiotics.
And isn't there also a danger of hospital-induced infection? I mean, aren't these IV lines really difficult to decontaminate of all bacteria, to sterilize?
Well, it's not that so the first answer is yes. There are about 2 million hospital-acquired infections per year in this country alone, just in the United States. So hospital-acquired infections are one of the biggest problems in terms of dangers of being in the hospital. It's not because the plastic is contaminated when it goes in. No, the plastic is sterile. Think about it the other way. The bacteria are all around us in the environment. Our bodies have more bacteria in them than human cells in them. There's an estimated 10 trillion human cells in our body. There are 100 trillion bacteria in our body. So our bodies themselves are loaded with bacteria. The walls of the hospital, the floors of the hospital, there's bacteria all over the environment. Now you've got a plastic tube that directly connects the environment to your bloodstream. If you've got closed skin, the bacteria can't get through it. But now you've got a direct access. And so any bacteria that get on the tip of that catheter after it's put into the patient, or get on any tubing connected that ultimately gets connected to that catheter, can directly inject bacteria into the bloodstream, for example. There are other forms of hospital-acquired infections as well, but they often relate to the fact that we disrupt the normal anatomical barriers in patients when they're getting critical care. We put tubes in your throat down into your lungs so you can breathe. We put tube into your bladder to help you pee. So all those things create artificial routes of entry for environmental bacteria to get into the body.
Well, this sounds really terrifying. And just to add a little bit more to the scare, I understand that there's also kind of gene swapping so that multi-drug-resistant bacteria are also becoming more virulent, that there's some way in which different bacteria are learning from other ones and infections are getting not only more resistant but also more virulent, more serious. Is that right?
Well, so I think we need to be careful not to sort of mix metaphors or terms. When we talk about virulence, one way to say it is, well, are you more likely to die? And the answer is, if I can't treat you, if I can't give you an antibiotic because you're resistant to the antibiotics, you're more likely to die. That's unequivocally true. That isn't, as a strict scientific term, that is not virulence. That is simply the normal history, the sort of natural history of an infection in the absence of antibiotic therapy. Well, more fair comparison is you take two bacteria that either can be treated or can't be treated and compare the outcomes of those different bacteria in a patient. Some bacteria are better able to cause disease, cause worse disease, even if they can be treated. That would be a virulence difference. And I don't think that it's very complicated. I don't think you can say that bacteria are becoming more virulent. I don't think that's true. Some bacteria are more virulent. Some bacteria are less virulent. The problem is if we run out of antibiotics, the death rates go up no matter what the virulence of the bacteria is.
And I also wonder, I mean, after all, you know, the antibiotic era is pretty new. It's just came in at the end of World War II and beyond since then. Before that, you know, people died of infections. Infectious disease was, I guess, the leading cause of death. But I wonder, did people before the antibiotic era, had they developed resistances to infection that protected populations to a certain degree that we've lost because of antibiotics?
There is something called the hygiene theory, which is based on the fact that things like allergies and asthma are being detected at a higher incidence than they used to be detected at. And immunologists argue back and forth whether that's because we are not as exposed to environmental bacteria or fungi today as compared to how we used to be. That may or may not be the case. I do not think it is true that we are more susceptible to infections than we used to be because of toxins or because of cleanliness in the environment. In many ways, I think we're less susceptible to infection than we used to be because of better nutrition and better public health hygiene, like sewer systems. What is absolutely true, though, is that intensive care medicine, complicated surgeries, cancer chemotherapy, rising rates of diabetes because of obesity, those things do predispose you to infections. So in some ways, people are living longer now than ever before. So this is the other argument. It's hard to say we're less healthy than we used to be when our lifespan has continued to go up. But because we're living longer, you get a variety of complications that put you in the hospital. And in order to keep you alive, we do a bunch of complicated medical interventions, all of which, as a side effect, can predispose you to getting infections.
Well, this is a very complicated story. And in your book, Brad Spellbergen, Rising Plague, you talk a lot at length about the reasons why new antibiotics are not being developed. And I think that's the big question that's been begged by our discussion so far. Why aren't they being developed?
The reason we have what is now being called a market failure of antibiotics is a sort of the result of three converging factors. There are scientific challenges, there are economic challenges, and there are regulatory challenges. The science is that the low-hanging fruit has been plucked. the stuff that's easy to discover has been discovered. There's about 140 antibiotics that have been developed for human use across the globe over the last 80 years. And so we're at a point where if you want to discover the next generation, it's becoming harder and harder to do that. It's more expensive to do that. It takes longer to do that. It's riskier to do that. And that's happening, that scientific challenge is happening right at the same time where the revenues of antibiotics are really not competitive with other classes of drugs for a variety of reasons. But the most pressing is that you take an antibiotic for 7 or 10 days and then you stop and you get cured of your disease. And companies can make much more money selling a drug you have to take every day for the rest of your life. A drug for diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, arthritis, dementia. These are things that result in much greater sales. And so you've got this rising scientific challenge and drugs that don't make you that much money anyway. And for complex statistical reasons, there has been a huge regulatory shift at the Food and Drug Administration. And although it's gotten better in the last 1 to 2 years, for a decade before that, the statisticians that were driving this discussion had made it much riskier and much more expensive to do clinical trials of antibiotics than ever before. And so all three factors are together. You've got drugs that are difficult and risky and expensive to discover. You've got not a big downstream reward, so companies would rather invest in other disease areas. And at the same time, it's becoming more expensive and risky because of regulatory requirements. And all that factor together is why companies have been getting out of the business of making new antibiotics.
When you talk about the FDA standards for the development of new drugs, many people would say, well, isn't the problem that we have too little regulation, not too much? I mean, for example, antibiotics being used in animal husbandry is something that is, you know, the FDA was only willing to suggest that farmers stop using antibiotics to make their animals grow faster and bigger rather than mandating it. So could you parse this for us? What's good regulation and what's not good regulation? What are some of the guidelines? Because I don't think we'd want to throw out the baby with the bath.
And again, there's some mixed metaphors here. So I think you alluded to, I think, the correct answer. Here I'm going to paraphrase Barack Obama. Who said, you know, famously about the Iraq war, he wasn't against all wars, he was against stupid wars. Well, I'm not against regulations. I'm against stupid regulations. So the issue with antibiotics and animal feed is a completely distinct issue from how you regulate clinical trials to see if new antibiotics are safe and effective. The antibiotics and animal feed issue is a political hot potato. I mean, the bottom line is the FDA really is not in a position to mandate things when Congress is simply going to override or overrule them. That is a congressional problem. That is not an FDA problem. The FDA is the public face of it because they're the regulatory body, but they're hamstrung by Congress. That's the bottom line at the end of the day. You know, Congress is in this issue, a substantial proportion of Congress really responds aggressively to an agribusiness lobby that is very potent. So if the FDA acted decisively to ban antibiotics from animal feed, they'd simply get overruled. That is a completely distinct issue from creating the rules under which you conduct a clinical trial to know if a new antibiotic is safe or effective. And the bottom line is that for a decade or so, fairly unreasonable statistical concerns made people question whether antibiotics actually are better than placebo, which is a nonsensical question to ask. And it took a lot of time and effort for us to build the evidentiary basis to make that clear to statisticians. This is akin to asking about whether parachutes are more effective than placebos for jumping out of an airplane. No one's ever done a randomized clinical trial to show that parachutes are better than placebo for jumping out of an airplane. Well, you know what? Same way, I can't take a patient with pneumonia and randomize them to placebo. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of data that prove beyond any reasonable doubt that antibiotics are vastly more effective than placebo. Not only that, they're among the most effective medical interventions that we have. We have all kinds of data to support that. And it took a long time to build the case so that the statisticians backed off. This is an unreasonable evidentiary requirement that the statisticians have attempted to foist upon us. That is not the same issue as should we ban antibiotics for growth promotional purposes from livestock.
So if the FDA has relaxed the rules somewhat and that issue has gotten better, are companies, you know, for example, drug company Wyeth, which you talk about, which was a leader in developing antibiotics, but I think I saw on a Frontline or a Nova report that, you know, they've just, it's not in their business plan to do it because it doesn't make money for their shareholders. Have they come back in?
No. So Wyeth doesn't exist anymore. Wyeth was swallowed up by Pfizer. And at the time, Pfizer had, after they swallowed Wyeth, had the largest antibiotic discovery program, I think, in the world. And then they shut it down, and it's gone. And they followed the trend. And so, you know, if you looked 20 to 25 years ago, there were more than 20 large pharmaceutical companies that had discovery programs for antibiotics. Now there's 2 to 3, depending on how you count. And I think that shift, which has been catastrophic in some ways, because it's not just a matter of a smaller number of companies. You basically force scientists to change their career direction, and you lose the experience and knowledge and expertise of these scientists that are no longer working in antibiotics. They get put on other disease areas like diabetes, for example. I think what we're seeing now is a shift in discovery efforts from large companies to small to mid-sized companies. There are small to mid-sized companies working in this space. It remains to be seen whether we've actually hit the turnaround point or not. I think we probably are at bottom in terms of industrial activity. Whether we're coming off bottom, I think, remains to be seen.
And what about government? I mean, why can't, if this is a market failure and the lives of millions of people depend on developing new antibiotics, why can't governments come in to take over from the private companies? Why can't they snap up those scientists?
This is a great question, and I think that the answer is slightly more nuanced, but you're heading in the right direction. So let's get one thing really clear. There are no antibiotics on the planet that have ever been developed by a government, period. Every single antibiotic on the planet was developed by a for-profit company. There is a malarial drug that was developed by the Chinese army. So you could say there's a malarial agent out there that demonstrates this can be done by government. But basically, governments don't discover and develop new drugs. They don't have the expertise to do it. They generally don't even have the access to capital to do it. What we'd like to see more of, and are starting to see more of, are what are called public-private partnerships, where government puts up upfront dollars to defray cost and risk of discovery and development, but partners with private companies to actually do the development then. This is a fundamental shift in the business model of drug companies. Drug companies have historically used something called an entrepreneurial business model. That is, they take all the upfront risk and cost. It's their money on the line. And in return, because they have spent a lot of money and taken a lot of risk in discovery, they expect a large profit margin downstream. The opposite model is the defense contractor model, where most of the upfront R&D costs are borne by the government. And in return, when you start selling the product to the government has a lot of control over what price it pays. That same model, more of a public-private partnership model, is probably where we need to go with antibiotics. And so we'll have increasing partnerships between government and industry, kind of like defense contractors. And that actually is already happening. There are some very successful public-private partnerships that have been set up both in the U.S. and Europe. And I would say that the agencies in government, one of them is called BARDA, and the other one is at NIH, the biggest ones, I think those have really been sort of the life support for the barely breathing corpse of antibiotic development in the U.S. at this point.
Now, you also raise the issue in your book, Brad Spellberg, In Rising Plague. You raise the issue of priorities in spending, because with these public-private partnerships, if they're really to succeed on the scale that we need them, they're going to take a lot of resources. And with a lot of people crying, oh, deficit reduction and government can't do anything right, and huge amounts of money going to already outlays that we have. Well, just comment on that and talk about where you think this needs to be going.
Well, I think that, you know, we all have to be sensitive to the fact that the country is $15 trillion in debt, right? And so to ignore that fact is to put your head in the sand. On the other hand, all of us have a risk of being in the hospital. All of us have loved ones that have a risk of being in the hospital. All of us can get urinary tract infections or belly infections. And so all of us are in this together. Antibiotics are a communal property. They are very different than other classes of drugs. When you take an antibiotic, it affects the ability of an antibiotic to work for me and everyone I care about. And when I take it, same thing for you. That's not true of any other drug. The same cholesterol drugs and diabetes drugs and arthritis drugs that we have today are going to work just as well 50 years from today as they do today. And that's not true of antibiotics. So we're all in this together. And you certainly need to incorporate that concern. This is a huge public health concern. As you begin to prioritize where dollars get spent, the advantage of the public-private partnership model is exactly that you don't rely on government to do the discovery and development. You rely on government dollars to help direct where the discovery and development should go into unmet need. So the flip side of this is, listen, if I'm a big company and I do decide I want to spend money on antibiotics, I'm not going to develop a drug to treat 10,000 people who have untreatable infection. I'm going to try to develop a drug that treats 4 million infections. I want a larger number of people. I want to sell more drug. Those are markets that are very crowded. I don't need any new therapies in those markets. I need therapies to treat these highly resistant pathogens, even if that's not the biggest money maker for those companies. That's why we need public-private partnerships.
And there's also the point that if we do have these, I mean, these infections must be hugely expensive once at this point as it is. I mean, they must be already costing billions of dollars.
Yeah, so that's a great point that I'm glad you reminded me of to mention, is that the best estimates are that antibiotic-resistant infections cost the U.S. healthcare system somewhere between $20 and $30 billion a year. And so, again, investment in new therapies so that you're not dealing with resistance anymore, you actually have an active treatment for the infection, will pay off downstream by reducing your healthcare costs.
So finally, looking forward, Dr. Spellberg, looking forward, do you have reasons for hope? Do you think this is beginning to turn around, or do we need to do a whole lot more work? And if so, who do we need to talk to?
I think there is always reason for hope. So you know, just to sort of get the elephant in the room out of the way, I've had people ask me, are we talking about the end of civilization? And the answer, of course, is no. We had civilization for 10,000 years before we even knew what an antibiotic was. What we're talking about if we lose antibiotics is a markedly shorter lifespan, probably on the order of 20 to 30 years shorter on average, and a substantially lower quality of life. So it's a huge issue, but it's not a civilization killer. We're not talking about that, right? And so there is hope. There is hope that if we think strategically and disruptively and aren't locked into the old ways of doing things, that we can advance. The advancement can't be just, hey, I discovered a new antibiotic, because within 10 years, resistance will have caught up to that too. And it can't be just, well, let's not discover any new antibiotics. Let's just focus on saving the ones we have, because eventually they're all going to go. It has to be multimodal. We need better infection prevention so there's fewer infections in the first place. We need better, quote-unquote, antibiotic stewardship so that we don't waste the antibiotics that we already have. We need new discovery of antibiotics. And we need perhaps to start thinking about changing the way we think of disease, because we're learning that the disease from an infection is as much caused by the human response to the bacteria as it is by the bacteria itself. And this opens up exciting new avenues for science, that maybe we can find ways to treat infections that are not dependent on killing the bacteria, but are rather dependent upon changing the way that the host interacts with the bacteria so disease doesn't ensue. That strategy, those kinds of strategies, are less likely to promote resistance. Resistance is the result of trying to kill bacteria that don't want to die. So you need sort of a broad, systematic approach. The good news is that Congress is aware of the problem. The White House is aware of the problem. Government agencies are aware of the problem. So we're past the point where we were at 10 years ago where we had to convince people this is a problem. And now we're at the point of starting to explore the most effective solutions. And that's why I think there's hope. Because I think we're now messaging correctly, and now we need to push to get the solutions in place.
Clarification. So are you talking about an approach that in some ways boosts the immune response or the ability of the body to fight off infection itself?
Well, there's many different ways to play it. And in fact, it may be that you actually want to suppress the immune response. So a huge amount of the damage that is caused by many types of infections is that the human body overreacts to the bacteria. And a lot of the damage is from friendly fire. It's the host trying to get the bacteria out of tissue, and in doing so, it chews up its own tissue, the host white blood cells. And so there's reason to believe that for many types of infections, we actually need to be suppressing the host response and allowing the bacteria to be cleared by antibiotics and a more slow, calm, gradual clearance by the host immune system so that it doesn't overreact. For other types of infections, it will be necessary to immune enhance to prevent infections or to make them get cleared faster. So each type of infection is going to require a different approach. But I think the key is that we understand now that we don't have to get locked into the paradigm that the only way to treat infections is to kill the bacteria, that there may be other approaches we've never explored before that we should be exploring.
Well, this has just been a terrific conversation. Dr. Brad Spellberg, it's a terrific book, Rising Plague, The Global Threat from Deadly Bacteria and Our Dwindling Arsenal to Fight Them. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Brad Spellberg's book is Rising Plague. He appeared on the PBS Frontline episode, Hunting the Nightmare Bacteria. Go to writersvoice.net for a link. Next up, we talk with Edward McClelland about how the loss of strong unions led to the destruction of America's robust middle class. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The Upper Midwest and Great Lakes region was the birthplace of the American middle class. With union jobs that paid well and had good benefits, workers in the industrial heartland helped create decades of unprecedented prosperity for the nation. The beginning of the end came with the first big blow to the labor movement, when President Reagan broke the back of the Air Traffic Controllers Union. With the loss of the power of the strike, the unions lost the fight against deindustrialization. Wages have never recovered. My guest, Edward McClelland, follows that story in his book, Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. He was born in Lansing, Michigan in 1967 and was inspired to write his book when he saw the Fisher Body Plant across the street from his old high school torn down. Well, Edward McClelland, welcome to Writer's Voice. You write in this book, Nothing But Blue Skies, that America's greatest 20th century invention was the middle class. I think in the 21st century, we're seeing the demise of that class. And you set out to do a kind of travelogue of that demise. You went to places like Lansing, Michigan, where you grew up, to Buffalo, New York, Lackawanna, Pennsylvania, Cleveland, Ohio, and Chicago. Let's start where you start, Lansing, Michigan. Tell us about the Lansing of your youth and then what happened to it.
When I was growing up in Lansing, certainly automaking was just completely integrated into the fabric and into the life of the city. You know, I went to high school directly across the street from Fisher Body assembly plant, and we could, you know, smell the paint wafting over from the side, and we would see all the guys going. There was a bar and across from every gate, and we'd see the guys going to lunch or going for a drink after the shift. And, you know, you'd see those trucks that would haul 10 cars at a time on two levels. You'd always see them going across the Logan Street Bridge at the Grand River. So, I mean, we were very much an industrial, very much a blue-collar town, and I think it was like that for a lot of places in Michigan, certainly Flint, parts of Detroit, and Lansing had a little more to fall back on because we had the Michigan State University and we were the state capital, but that plant has been torn down because it was obsolete and they moved the operations out to a bigger plant outside of town, but they don't need as many workers as they used to need. either. There used to be something like 25,000 people, and now there are 5,000 people making the same number of cars. And the UAW is such a big force in the city that people would advertise for local president on the radio, and it's not as big a deal as it used to be.
You talk about the union movement and what happened to it, and you have a chapter about a family friend who was in the Flint sit-down strike of 1936. Tell us first about him and then about the strike and how different that was from the kind of union movement that's around today.
Well, yeah, Everett Ketchum, he was, I think, 21 years old at the time, and he was working at GM in Flint and for 50 cents an hour, and they didn't really have any job security. If the foreman wanted to put his brother in or his brother-in-law in, he could just give you a yellow slip and you were done. And they'd speeded up the lines to what the workers thought was an inhuman level. And Michigan had just elected a New Deal governor, so the workers just one day stopped working and occupied the plant. And they didn't leave until they had a contract guaranteeing them job security and guaranteeing them a 5 cent an hour raise. And I think the difference between the union movement then and the union movement today is that the union movement then had support from the government, both the federal government when Franklin D. Roosevelt was president, and in Michigan's case, the state government when Frank Murphy was governor. So I think in the last 30, 35 years, that's really been withdrawn. I mean, the strike has almost disappeared as a labor tactic because workers can simply be replaced if they walk out.
Yeah, some people put that down to the PATCO strike, the air.
Well, yeah, that's certainly when it started. You know, a lot of people feel like that was the beginning of the end of the union movement. And, you know, with Everett, it certainly guaranteed him a prosperous lifestyle. I mean, he ended up moving to East Lansing because he married a woman who worked for Michigan State University and ended up owning several rental properties and a nice house of his own. And, you know, eventually he had guaranteed health care for life, which was one reason he lived to be 98 years old.
Yeah, and that PATCO strike, that's when Reagan basically broke the back of the airport controllers union.
Right, he fired the air traffic controllers who had actually endorsed him for president, went on strike, and that sent a signal to private employers that they could do the same thing to their workers.
So would you say that had, you know, what happened to the union movement had something to do with the hollowing out of the middle class?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've seen many charts. I mean, in the 50s, when the country was at its most prosperous, 30% of workers belonged to unions. Now only 6% of private sector workers belong to unions. And I've seen charts that they show union membership and median income declining at the same rate.
When 30% of workers belong to unions, well, that still means 70% don't.
Well, it does, but the UAW and other unions, they sort of set the level for what everybody else was earning. The auto industry was probably the preeminent industry in the nation. So if the auto workers were making a lot of money, everyone else was making a lot of money. I mean, it ended up lifting everybody's wages.
So maybe it's the union movement that, in fact, is the tide that lifts all boats, not capital.
Absolutely.
I really enjoyed your chapter on Cleveland. Some things have gotten better in Cleveland, like the Cuyahoga River has gotten a bit cleaned up. But as you say in your book, Ted McClelland, and as you say in Nothing But Blue Skies, that even that was tied to the economic hollowing out of Cleveland's middle class. So connect the dots for us. What was going on with the Cuyahoga River back in the 30s and the 60s, and then why is it so much cleaner now?
Back in that era, it was basically just used as a dump by industry, by the paint company. They'd say you could tell what they had too much of by looking at the color of the river. The steel mills would dump waste in there. And the famous Cuyahoga River fire in 1969 that inspired the Time magazine article and then ended up inspiring the Clean Water Act wasn't even the biggest fire that they had. They had a bigger fire in the 50s where downtown Cleveland looked like Pearl Harbor. There was just smoke rising stories and stories up in the air. And part of it was that it forced these steel mills to clean up. But some people say that because steel mills were forced to clean up, that's what ended up driving them out of Cleveland. I mean, there's still being steel made on the Cuyahoga River, but not as much as there used to be. And fewer steel mills means less pollution, but it also means fewer good union jobs.
Yeah, this is a really interesting point because, you know, I think as you point out, the environmental movement got a huge boost from the outrage of the burning of the Cuyahoga River. And certainly, we don't want to say that companies should just be allowed to toxify and dump anywhere they want to. Was it inevitable that once forced to clean up, that these companies would leave, or could something have been done that would have allowed for the cleanup of the river and the maintenance of those jobs in Cleveland?
Well, I don't think it was inevitable, and I certainly don't think it was the only reason that these plants moved out. Some of the plants were just obsolete, and it was cheaper to build a new plant somewhere else where you could get cheap land. A lot of the steel making just moved overseas because labor was cheaper over there. Certainly the environmental movement and the labor movement have quite often been at odds because the labor movement feels that environmental regulations are going to cost jobs. But I don't think you can say it was just environmental regulations that have driven steel out of the United States. Because, I mean, a lot of steel is still being made in other countries with strong environmental relations, such as Germany. So globalization certainly played a factor as well.
And Germany actually has pretty high wages, too.
Right, pretty high wages, and unionized. Actually, there's a fight going on in Tennessee now because Volkswagen wants its workers to unionize, and a lot of politicians, conservative politicians there, don't want unions to get a toehold in the South.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Edward McClelland about his wonderful book, Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. You also write about Cleveland as ground zero of the foreclosure crisis. Talk about why it was ground zero.
Well, that was something I discovered, and I wasn't kind of expecting to discover. Cleveland was a place where a lot of people were abandoning houses. The older people were dying off, and the kids didn't want the houses. So there was this market for people looking to flip houses. And it had really weak lending laws and banking laws. And companies such as Countrywide took advantage of that to move in and to start writing adjustable-rate mortgage loans to people who just weren't qualified to get loans at all. Or they would go around And there were also people who had lost their jobs, in a steel mill or an auto plant. And they would go around and they would either say, hey, you need to fix that roof or the city's going to write you a ticket. Or they'd say, hey, there's a way for that you can still keep living the lifestyle you've been living, and that is to take out another mortgage on your home and, we'll help you write one. And they didn't tell them that the rates were going to go up over time. So at one time, Cuyahoga County had more foreclosures per capita than any county in the United States. And of course, once that program succeeded there, they tried it all over the country. But Cleveland was where they really tested it out.
And you also say that deindustrialization actually laid the groundwork for the mortgage meltdown.
Well, yeah, because people would lose their jobs, and they were used to a certain standard of living, and they'd bought a house, maybe they'd been paying for it, maybe they'd already paid it off after 30 years. But this was the only thing of value they had, and housing values were so artificially inflated in the late 1990s and early 2000s that these people would come around and, they'd write them a $100,000 mortgage for a home that might only be worth $75,000 and said, hey, you can just keep using your home as an ATM. And some people ended up losing their homes as a result of that.
It's a real contrast to Chicago, where you live now, President Obama's hometown, and you wrote a book called Young Mr. Obama, Chicago and the Making of a Black President. You say it's gone from a city of factories to a global financial nexus. How did this happen, and what's been the impact?
30 years ago, people thought Chicago was going to end up, when the steel mills were shutting down, when Wisconsin Steel, the shutdown of Wisconsin Steel was actually what drew Obama to Chicago. to work with a community organization that was helping to retrain laid off steel workers. So, you know, I say he's the first Rust Belt president. And people thought it was going to go the same way as Cleveland or Buffalo or Detroit. But number one, Chicago always had a much more diversified economy than those cities. I mean, it always had banking, it had publishing, it had finance, it had insurance. So it was better positioned to make the shift from when, you know, thinking about things was going to become more valuable than making things in America. And I think another factor is that, you know, it's a factor of globalization. There was, once this happened, there was only really going to be room for one Midwestern metropolis, you know, one big city in the Midwest. And I remember someone in Cleveland asking me, well, what did Chicago do right? And they were asking me, obviously, that because they wanted to know what Cleveland could do right. And I think my conclusion was Chicago's success comes at the expense of all these other cities. I moved to Chicago not long after I got out of college, and it's almost become a rite of passage for college students all over the Midwest to move to Chicago. Chicago is sort of getting a free ride off of the university systems of other states because it's getting all their college graduates. I went to Michigan State, and Chicago is the number one destination now for recent Michigan State graduates.
So let's go back to when you talked about we talked about the middle class, and you pointed out it was the greatest American invention of the 20th century. What's going on? Is there still a vibrant middle class in Chicago? Or, you know, what's been the social impact of the shift from a city of factories to a global nexus?
I wrote an article this week for the American Prospect. People might want to look up. There's not the blue-collar middle class that there used to be here. So now it's a city of maybe, you know, a third of the city is made up of wealthy professionals, mostly white, mostly living on the lakefront, and two-thirds of the city is made up of less well-to-do minorities, you know, living in remote neighborhoods and mostly doing service jobs, you know, working things like food preparation or driving taxi cabs and, you know, serving these global citizens, you know, these people who've been drawn to Chicago from all over the region and all over the country to work in these globalized businesses. So, I mean, Chicago has always been a very segregated city, but in some ways it's become a more economically divided city than it was 30 or 40 years ago. And, you know, one thing I look at is I wonder, was the middle class just a fluke of the 20th century? And I read an article yesterday, there's a new book out by a guy named Thomas Piketty, where, you know, he makes the same argument that because of World War One and World War Two and the Depression, we were the middle class. For most of human history, there are two classes: there are aristocrats and peasants, and we were able to escape that stratification in the 20th century because of certain historical forces. But, you know, as he argues and as I've argued, that the natural drift of capitalism is to concentrate all the wealth among fewer and fewer people. And the only way that can be arrested is if the government steps in as a referee. So I think if we want a middle class back, it's going to take activism.
Yeah. He also says, because I read that same article with great interest, and then went on to some of his own writings. You know, he says that the only solution is redistribution of the wealth through confiscatory taxation, the kind of taxation that we actually had under the New Deal of the wealthy class.
But he says the only way to do it is to do it worldwide, which is impossible because, you know, if one country has confiscatory taxation, people can take their money to another country. They can take it to the Cayman Islands.
Exactly. And they do, as we know. So that's a very interesting, because we're talking right now soon after Obama has given the State of the Union address, his first of his new, second administration. And, you know, he declared in it his support for bringing good manufacturing jobs back to America, what he calls promise zones, kind of a retread of the old empowerment zones, none of which, by the way, is in the Rust Belt except Philadelphia. What do you think of his approach?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good idea, but we have to make sure these jobs are gonna pay well if they come back here. I mean, some of the jobs now starting at General Motors, now they only pay, they have this two-tier system where the new employees only earn $14 an hour, which no one would consider a middle-class wage. I mean, there's nothing that automatically says industrial jobs have to pay well and service jobs don't have to pay well. We have to make sure that workers are well paid, and we can do that by raising the minimum wage and also by ensuring that workers have the right to organize.
Yeah, you write about one auto worker who had to take the two-tier system. Tell us her story. Tell us what happened to her.
Well, she was making over $20 an hour, but I think because she was not, for some reason, considered a permanent employee, she was reclassified into this second tier, and she had to go down to $14 an hour, a wage at which she could barely survive. And this was a woman who worked at the GM plant in Lordstown, Ohio. And so there were a lot of these new workers coming in at this rate, and they just didn't have the same dedication, didn't have the same devotion to quality that workers who were earning $28 an hour did. Things got too tough. They just walked off the line and said, hey, I'm going back to Home Depot. It's a lot easier, and the pay's almost as good.
She could barely even make her own mortgage. I mean, she
right.
wasn't
yeah.
she wasn't eating well enough.
Exactly.
And finally, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the Great Lakes region. You went to Lackawanna, New York. You went to a U.S.
Right.
steel plant that's being taken over by a kind of post-industrial nature. Give us a setting. Tell us what it looked like and what happened to Lackawanna.
Well, that was a plant that had been that was closed in 1982, and really because it was going to be so expensive to clean up, it had just been left to abandon to nature, more or less. And so I went out there with sort of a guide to wildflowers, and I was kind of just trying to catalog the flora of post-industrialization, and so I found plants such as goldenrod and chicory and yarrow and spotted knapweed, and I saw deer out there, and the use that they have found for it is they have built these windmills, which can power thousands of homes, and they've kind of become a symbol of Buffalo. If you watch Buffalo Bills games, they'll sort of show them. They're these giant striking windmills right along the lake, because there's always wind coming off Lake Erie, and that became the cover photo of the book. You could see this abandoned piece of industrial equipment, and behind it were rising these windmills. So I think that they're starting to do something else with it there now. I think there's a little train track going through there, but at the time, that was about all they had going for them.
And so is this kind of a note of hope in the Rust Belt? Do you think that
green... that's why I wanted to call it Nothing But Blue Skies, because the title actually came from someone in South Chicago who said to me after the steel mill, U.S. Steel closed there, he said, I looked up and saw a blue sky and I thought it was the end of the world. And so Nothing But Blue Skies is what you have left after the factory leaves, but it's also a blank slate. It's something you can use to build a new way of urban living, as they're doing in places like Youngstown or in Flint, where they're trying to reclaim a lot of this empty urban space for things like parks and urban agriculture, and not trying to be the steel town anymore, but be the best town of 70,000 people or 100,000 people that they can be.
I've even heard that Cleveland is trying to reinvent itself with green industry. Is that right? Did you see that?
I haven't seen so much in Cleveland. What I saw in Cleveland was Cleveland sort of getting artists to move into what had once been small manufacturing buildings that were emptied out after NAFTA was passed. But I know in Lansing they're trying to convert what was the Fisher Body site into a green energy center. They haven't had any success with that, but certainly what they did in Buffalo with these windmills, that was taking an old industrial site and converting it to green energy. So it is happening in some places.
And yet you also look at Syracuse, New York, which The birthplace of the air conditioner, and you say, and that was in fact what led to the demise of the Northeast. I think you're a bit tongue in cheek, but talk about.
As they said, there's a book about the inventor of the air conditioner. They said a place like Houston wouldn't be habitable without air conditioning. That allowed people to move down south. I mean, Carrier itself moved a lot of its operations down south because, A, it was closer to its marketplace, and B, the South has a very anti-union tradition, so they wouldn't have to pay the workers as much there.
So the first wave of deindustrialization.
It advantaged a region that's traditionally been hostile to labor. So it was really a double whammy in that way.
The first time that you could actually have manufacturing in the South because of the air conditioning.
Right. Well, they had steel in Birmingham, but they didn't have a lot of manufacturing in the South. It was mostly a rural agricultural area up until the late 20th century. Now they're building auto plants down there.
But yet Syracuse has been able to build some high-tech industry. You say that high-tech, though, has replaced mass production. So, you know, is that kind of a bringing manufacturing jobs? You know, I think there's a lot of touting of, well, we may not, especially with this new TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which is being pushed by Obama. You know, the idea is, well, we'll have good high-tech manufacturing jobs here.
Right.
You know, what do you think of that?
I think that's the way we have to go because, I mean, we can't compete with countries like Bangladesh and Vietnam to make T-shirts and shoes. We can't compete with their low wages. But there was a business in my hometown of Lansing that I profiled. It's called NioWave, and they made particle accelerators for use in medical equipment and defense equipment. And what the guy told me was that Lansing was one of the few places he could do it because they had both the sort of academic knowledge or scientific knowledge, and they had people with the ethic of and the skills of craftsmanship who could build these things. And these were mostly guys who had worked at General Motors and retired there. So in America, what we are is we're innovative and we're highly skilled. We're never going to be the low wage center where you can offshore your work. So yeah, I think that's exactly the way we need to go.
Is that going to bring back the American middle class?
Well, you know, as I said, it's not just the jobs. We have to make sure the jobs pay well. I think we could bring back some of the middle class if we just made sure that these jobs that have replaced the industrial jobs pay better. I mean, that's been one of the greatest successes of the anti-union movement is in preventing the unionization of jobs like fast food and data processing and all the little things people are doing now. There's no reason those jobs can't pay, maybe not as well as automaking, but better than they pay now. So I think it has to be a combination of jobs and of making sure that employees have a right to negotiate for higher wages.
Edward McClellan, you've been talking to us about your wonderful book. I found it a really terrific read. Nothing But Blue Skies, The Heyday, Hard Times, and Hopes of America's Industrial Heartland. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Edward McClellan is also the author of The Third Coast. He's written for the New York Times, LA Times, Salon, Slate, and The Nation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.